Okay, welcome. This is the Dana Pritzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio Network. Tonight, Carmen Mercer, Vice President of the Minutemen, will join me. Clint Van Zandt, former FBI agent, author, and expert on hostage-taking. Jan Smolinski, whose son William Smolinski is missing. J. Paul Daratani will be here to talk about the Nancy Grace lawsuit. And then Dave Holloway will be here to talk about his missing daughter, Natalie. That's tonight on the Dana Pritzer Show here on the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pritzer Show for January 21st. Is it the 21st? Yeah. January 21st, 2007. How many of you have been writing 2006 on everything like I have been? A story that has touched the nation, actually has touched North America, is the story of the two Texas Border Patrol agents, Agent Ramos and Compine, who have begun serving a jail sentence for doing their job. Basically, they ended up shooting a Mexican drug dealer. I think he had over 700 pounds of marijuana when they were dealing with him. They shot him in the butt, and they were convicted of violating his civil rights. There were some questions as far as cover up and all that sort of stuff, but there has been a effort made by several organizations, including the organization of my first guest, Carmen Mercer, VP of the Minutemen, to ask President Bush to pardon these two agents because, well, they were just doing their job. The president has pardoned a lot worse, and I thought I'd bring Carmen on to talk about that for the first part of the show. Carmen, welcome back to the Dana Pritzer Show.
Thanks for having me again, Dana. And you're right. You know, to us, the first charge and issue should have been that there was a drug smuggler involved that brought almost 750 pounds of marijuana into the country illegally. However, our government decided that they needed to punish the Border Patrol agents who were in the line of duty, who did, according to us, the right thing, who tried to apprehend the drug smuggler. And as we have seen it in the past so many times, it seems like the government is more in favor of the illegal activities coming into our country than to reward the agents who are doing their job. And of course, it also paints a bad picture for the future for future agents, you know, Border Patrol agents. I mean, do they even have the courage to do their job anymore, or will they have to be afraid of being convicted of charges that should have never happened? And of course, certainly now, I think the pressure of the American public, I really do believe that that is the reason for President Bush even thinking about pardoning these two agents, is because of the involvement of the American public, of the American people, of sending the emails, of doing the phone calls, of sending the faxes, and telling President Bush that he needs to step up to the plate and pardon these two agents for what they have done, for what they have not done.
Some of the information I have here says that the president last month issued 16 N pardons, 5 cases involving drug crimes, while others involved bank fraud, mail fraud, and the acceptance of a kickback. In 2005, the president pardoned 14 people, including a member of the Mine Workers Union who was convicted for his role in bombings at a West Virginia coal mine, a counterfeiter, several dealers of marijuana, an LSD, and a bootlegger. Well, good Lord. You have two agents, and I'm not sure exactly what the Border Patrol agents get paid. I don't imagine it's hardly anything. Law enforcement traditionally in North America are way underpaid for the job that they do, but they are doing an extremely dangerous job. Carmen, you know it as well as anyone. They are undermanned, underpaid, and this has to be a morale kick in the butt for the Border Patrol and those who are considering a career in Border Patrol?
You're absolutely right, Dana. You know, the normal pay for Border Patrol agents starts anywhere in the low 20s per year, and so that's not very much money. And it takes a lot of patriotism, it takes a lot of courage, it takes a lot of conviction to do the job as a Border Patrol agent, because we all know that they're undermanned, that they're underpaid, and they're still trying to do the right thing. And we certainly have supported them in the last 5 years that we have patrolled the border and that we have gotten in communications with the Border Patrol agents. We have a great rapport with them. They're perfectly happy with us being there because they know we're only the eyes and the ears of the Border Patrol. We're not some vigilantes as the president makes us out to be. We're just there to help them being able to apprehend so many of the illegal aliens who are breaking into this country. And, you know, by allowing the drug smuggler to go, the thing that surprised me was the government agencies found the drug smuggler, whereas the Border Patrol agents could not identify the drug smuggler. But then our government agencies found the drug smuggler and brought him back to put the charges against our Border Patrol agents, which is totally crazy. You're right. The president is pardoning people for other instances, and he certainly needs to pardon these two Border Patrol agents. And, of course, my concern is what would be even better is to retry them and then acquit them, which would be even better. You know, but even if he pardons them, we all feel that these two Border Patrol agents were in their line of duty. They did the correct thing. The first thing should be if we have illegal activities coming across the border, if we have illegal drugs coming across the border, our Border Patrol agents should be the ones who should be able to make the decisions that they are going to prevent that. And therefore, to me, these two Border Patrol agents should be pardoned.
This drug smuggler, Davila, or whatever his name is, was granted immunity from prosecution by the U.S. government for attempting to smuggle nearly 750 pounds of marijuana, which had a street value of more than $1 million, into the U.S. on the day that he was shot. He was treated in a U.S. hospital and is now suing, the federal government for $5 million. So he's trying to bring in, let me see if I can get this straight. Maybe I'm a bit slow on the uptake here, Carmen. He's committing a crime. He's entering the country illegally. He's bringing $1 million worth of illegal drugs into the country. The two Border Patrol agents do their job. They try to apprehend him. They say he has a gun. A gun was never found, but they get charged or get accused of tampering with evidence because they picked up their shell casings. Big whoop-de-doo. This is just totally bizarre. And that he was granted immunity, and now he's turning around and suing the government? Who has the rights here?
I know, and that's the thing that is outraging the American public. I mean, we now see pizza for pesos, you know, that kind of stuff. We had another illegal alien that was shot by a Border Patrol agent just recently here because he started throwing rocks to the Border Patrol agent, and the Border Patrol agent defended himself. It is a two-way thing. Yes, the illegal alien claims that he did not have a weapon. The two Border Patrol agent claims that they claim that they saw a weapon in the guy's hand. Plus, he brought almost 750 pounds illegal drugs into this country. I mean, my God, what does President Bush want us to do? I mean, we had an incursion about 3 weeks ago here in Arizona, in an area that we always patrol the border with the National Guard, where we now know that it was a planned attack from what we think the drug cartel coming from Mexico to check out and to see what reactions they would get from our National Guard. And it was confirmed to them that our National Guard will not do anything because they're not allowed to do anything according to our government's orders. I mean, where are we? Where are we coming from? Where are we standing? What can we do to let our agents know, to let our National Guard know, I mean, that we are there right with them, that we want them to protect the American people. We want them to protect the border, to secure the border. That's what they're there for. That's what President Bush called them in action for. That's what he called the National Guard in action for, to help out the Border Patrol to be more effective. But if we're punishing the agents for something that they should have done, and that was rightfully so. I mean, where is that going to take everybody else? Everybody will be scared to even do their job.
Ramos and Compin are serving their 11 and 12-year prison sentences. Has anybody heard anything? I think I saw a press release that the president is mulling the pardon, but there's a lot more needs to be done than just mulling. Again, here you have an illegal in the country who's claiming his civil rights were violated when he's not even a citizen, and he was pardoned or given immunity from bringing in $1 million worth of drugs. And I don't know many drug dealers who would have in their possession $1 million worth of drugs that wouldn't be carrying a weapon. I think it's asinine for the investigators and the prosecutors in this case to even try and rule out that fact. If it's a he said, he said, the credibility of the officers, the two Border Patrol agents, has to be considered. And as far as picking up the casings, as a law enforcement officer myself, Carmen, when you are trained on the range to shoot, and you're shooting and you're qualifying, the range officer will tell you when you're done, okay, pick up your empties. And I can see in the heat of the moment these officers picking up their empties. I can't see a complicity there to cover up. What would picking up the empties be a complicity for? My question to you is, Carmen, this is totally bizarre. You mentioned that the Border Patrol is supposedly supplemented by the National Guard, but the National Guard aren't allowed to do anything. So why are they there?
Well, the National Guard was implemented to help out the Border Patrol agents, which means the National Guard is repairing fences, is repairing the vehicles of the Border Patrol, so that the Border Patrol is freed up to do their job, which is not bad. However, the National Guard is there to protect our country, is there to protect our border, is there to protect the American public. And we have said, even when President Bush and the governor came out with the rule that the National Guard would not be able to protect themselves from the onslaught of illegal aliens coming into this country and breaking into this country. And it is definitely not right. And that's why we went, as the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps, we went and we stood side by side with the National Guard when the incident happened. But you're right when you say we've often encountered drug smugglers coming across the border, and not one time was there an incident when they did not have a weapon. Anytime you see a drug smuggler coming into this country carrying either marijuana or any other drugs, there's always a front person and a back person who carries either an automatic weapon or a rifle or a handgun.
Right.
And to me, it is very hard to believe that these guys were trying to smuggle these drugs into the country and they did not have a weapon. But, of course, it is so easy to paint the United States of America as the bad opponent who was responsible for this poor guy to be shot in the butt. You know, if I had seen the guy, if I had seen him push these drugs into the country, I don't know if I would have just shot him in the butt. You know, because to me, I believe in this country. I want to protect the people. I want to protect our border. We need to know the people who come into this country, what their intent is, and what background they have. And it's more than ever important that we secure this border and that we keep on building that fence that we have started, because if we don't do it, nobody else will, and our government certainly is not going to do it.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, Carmen Mercer, VP of the Minuteman Project, is here with me. We're discussing this case of the two Texas Border Patrol agents, Ramos and Compin, who are now serving a jail sentence for doing their job. The president is considering a pardon. The president has pardoned a lot worse, in my opinion, and hopefully he will do the same. I'm reading a quote here. It says, "I must remind the public that narcotic traffickers and human smugglers laugh at law enforcement as they know that the Johnny Suttons of the Department of Justice will not prosecute them and instead will prosecute officers who do their jobs and keep that poison off our streets and out of our schools, parks, and neighborhoods. Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Maricopa County has come out and said he does prosecute illegal aliens. He puts them in his jails. He is one sheriff who has come public. Are other law enforcement sheriffs, chiefs of police, etc., out there like Sheriff Arpaio, or is that few and far between, Carmen?
Well, it's few and far between, and he's surely an idol of many, many people because, you know, he takes the law into his hands, and he says it as it is, and he does it as it is, and he doesn't put up with any kind of ruckus from any agency himself. I mean, you know, and he's very successful. I mean, his prisoners don't have a problem with riots in his so-called jail, I mean, even though they're in a tent, but, you know, he has everything under control. And certainly, Ramos and Compion, you know, they should be recommended, they should be rewarded for standing up and fighting illegal drug traffic coming into the United States. And this is what CS, Minutemen Civil Defense Corps, have been fighting for 5 years. We know that our national security is at risk. We know that the public safety is at risk of the American people. And, you know, I immigrated to this wonderful country, and I still think it's the greatest country on earth. I became a citizen in 1999. I was born and raised in Germany, and I certainly think it's worthwhile to fight for this country, to fight for the safety, and to fight for the safety of the American people. And I will certainly keep on doing this until we have our border secured. And, you know, with the election coming up in 2008, my voice is a little hoarse because I have a cold.
That's
okay. But with the election coming up in 2008, we have candidates coming forward who will now start running for the presidency in 2008. And, you know, that's the way we have to do it. We have to unite the American people. We have to fight the Senate in trying to put the amnesty bill through and trying to put a guest worker program through. We cannot award illegal aliens breaking into this country and giving them the road to citizenship for something that is totally against the law. I came into this country. I had to wait in line. I had no problem with that. I had to go. I went to school here. I had to pay out-of-state tuition and fee. I had no problem with that. It never even came into my mind, why would I fight this? I mean, that's the law of the country. That's what I will accept and respect, and that's what everybody else who comes into this country needs to do.
Absolutely. Petitions with more than 225,000 signatures have been delivered to the White House, and all we can do is hope that the president will make the right decision. You brought it up, Carmen, and I was going to ask you about it anyway, with the candidates coming forward now, announcing their candidacy, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, etc., as far as the presidency in 2008. I'm curious what your thoughts are. Is there just empty rhetoric coming from the politicians, or do you actually see a politician out there, a presidential candidate or whatever, that has the border as a solid issue, one that needs to be taken care of?
Well, there are actually several candidates who would actually come into my mind, and we're not at this point to endorse or support any of them. What they really need to do, they have to come forward and make their statement even stronger, you know, for the public to see who they want to vote. But, of course, Tom Tancredo is a wonderful, wonderful person for the next election. Of course, he has immigration on the top priority on his mind, on his agenda. I know Tom personally. He's a no-bullshit person. He says it as it is, and he means it as he says it. And he is very straightforward, and his biggest concern is to secure this country, to make this country safe, to secure the border. And he certainly is a strong candidate to me. Ron Paul from Texas is another strong candidate. Duncan Hunter is even coming forward. You know, the more I listen to him, the more I like him. So there, for a while, we didn't know who we were going to vote for, who was even going to come up and even put their hat in the ringer. And it looks like there are good candidates coming up, and we certainly want them to make their issues known to the American public so that we as the American people can vote for the right person. And we've always said security on the border is the first issue, definitely for the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps, and there are quite a few people who will step up to that plate.
Absolutely. The country of Mexico is in the island of Aruba and other so-called tourist destinations. Mexico in particular has become a bastion of murder and mayhem. In fact, tourists from Canada, United States, and wherever are being slaughtered, for lack of a better term, and the government of Mexico is doing nothing about it. In fact, they're trying to place the blame on anyone so it doesn't affect their tourist dollar. From the Minuteman perspective, Carmen, how safe is Mexico? How dangerous is Mexico?
Well, I certainly have not ventured into Mexico for the last 5 years because I know I have a bounty on my head since I've become an activist in securing the border of the United States, and to accuse the Mexican government of being corrupt. You know, Mexico could be the second richest country in the world. They have plenty of resources. Unfortunately, it's a very politically corrupt, financially corrupt country, where the majority of the richness is kept amongst very few families, and the rest is below poverty level. And certainly that is not right. And I say, you know, very often when we have come across groups with a coyote in the group who spoke a little bit of English, we certainly told them, go back, you know, and take your rifle with you and fight against your own country, fight against your own government, and make them realize that it is their position to take responsibility for you people, to give you a better life, and not just take the money and keep it in very far and few between, and not let it come to the people of Mexico. And it really, Dana, it really is not a Mexican problem. The problem is that all our southern borders are bordering onto Mexico.
Right.
And certainly because the borders are so porous, it is such an easy job to enter into the United States, no matter from what country you're coming from, as long as you come through the Mexican border. And of course, a lot of people think the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps are racist against Mexican people. It has nothing to do with it. We welcome anybody, no different. It doesn't matter what color, what ethnic background you are, as long as you enter this country legally. We welcome people who come into this country legally with open arms. Those are the people that we want in this country. This is what this country is made out of. And we certainly have very many different ethnic backgrounds in our organization as well. And to come with the statement that the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps are racist is totally out of line. We have saved lives, I mean, almost 250 lives in the 5 years that we've been patrolling the border. The Border Patrol has been able to apprehend, with our help, more than 10,000 illegal aliens and put them back into their countries. So, you know, it's a cause that we need to work for, that we need to fight for. And I tell you, Dana, only when we unite, there are many, many groups out there that are claiming to have immigration reform on their agenda, that are claiming that they want illegal aliens to come into this country legally. And the more we unite, the better stand we have. The greater numbers we have, the more effective we are. But I tell you, if the American people realize how important this issue is, join the Minuteman. Go to the website, www.minutemanhq.com. Go and sign up. You can sign up to volunteer on the border. You can sign up to volunteer on the fence. You can even sign up for an internal chapter. You can go and work for the city government. Involve yourself in small city government. You know, the mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, who had the courage to stand up against his own government to do something about illegal aliens who were destroying his town and his city. And this is what we're working for. We're working to put as many people who have those kind of issues on their agenda into the government, into the city government or the federal government. It does not matter. We have created a Minuteman Political Action Committee as well. We will certainly support any candidate that has the safety, the national security issue of the American public on their mind.
Now, you have Minuteman Radio now, too. I think you should give a plug for that.
Yes, and that's actually where I'm going to be going on in about another half an hour. We have our own Minuteman Radio show. It's KKNT on 960 AM, radio, and we're on every Sunday from 7 to 9 Mountain Standard Time in Arizona here. And it's been great to you know, when Chris had the Tombstone Tumbleweed, the newspaper, that was our means to get the voice out to the American public. And now that the Tombstone Tumbleweed paper doesn't exist anymore, we now have the Minutemen radio show, and it certainly has helped to bring the voice out to the American people and to get the point across and to motivate people, and that's what it's all about. And I will not rest until I can get everybody off their couch, be involved, realize what it is all about, realize that we have drug gangs in this country who will not only stand on the border, they will come to your door, and they will not just ring on your door and ask for water and food. If you open your door to these kind of people, they will just simply shoot you. So, you know, people need to be aware that this is not a game anymore. This has to do with life and death. This has to do with securing the quality of life for our children and our grandchildren as well. And there's so much involved. There's health involved. I mean, there's just so much involved. It would take another hour to get all of these points across.
Well, Carmen, you are welcome on my program anytime. You folks are doing the Lord's work. I appreciate it. This is another voice for the Minutemen Project because it's an excellent project. Thanks for coming on, and let's hope for these Border Patrol agents.
Thanks so much, Dana, for having me again, and I'm looking forward to be on your show again. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Carmen Mercer, Vice President of the Minutemen Project. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be back in a minute with Clint Van Sant. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Ben Ownby and Sean Hornbeck were found alive. Michael Devlin has been charged with 2 counts of kidnapping. This is a bizarre case, to say the least. The Hornbeck boy had been with Devlin for 4 years. The media has been on this like a bird on a bug, saying, why didn't he go to the police? He talked to the police about his bicycle missing, yada, 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 all this sort of stuff. And I thought I would give my buddy Clint Van Zandt a shout, have him come on the air. He's an expert when it comes to hostage negotiations, former FBI agent, author. And I want to talk to Clint a little bit about something called the Stockholm Syndrome. Clint, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Dana. Thanks for having me.
Does the Stockholm Syndrome, we should maybe tell the folks what it is. Does it apply in this case?
Well, yeah, two things. Number one, it deals with a bank robbery that took place in about 1972 in Stockholm, Sweden. And an individual burst into a bank in Stockholm, starts cranking off some rounds into the ceiling, takes about four to five people hostage, if my memory is correct, to include two or three women and a man, straps dynamite to him and winds up herding him downstairs into the basement of the bank, where he then begins a standoff with the police. During the course of negotiations, he demands that a former cohort of his who's been in prison be brought from prison and brought into the bank, which, surprisingly enough, the police do. So now you got two bad guys with weapons and hostages inside the bank. Dana, as you know, this goes on for about 6 days. During the course of this, at least two or more of the tellers offered to perform sexual acts on the hostage takers. When the situation is finally resolved, one of the hostages starts a defense fund for the two bank robbers.
Jeez.
Yet another hostage winds up breaking off an engagement and becoming engaged to one of the hostage takers. So what the Stockholm Syndrome is, based upon that, it's a two-way relationship. It's where a hostage sees a hostage taker as, gee, this is somebody who determines if I live, die, if I eat, if I sleep. If they're successful, I live. If they're unsuccessful, I die. So I, as a hostage, identify with you, the hostage taker, because I want you to succeed, therefore I will live. And the converse of that is you, as the hostage taker, start to see me as a human being as opposed to just a warm piece of meat. And we start this kind of two-way relationship, the symbiotic relationship between the two. Now, I'll contrast that to what's called identification with the aggressor. That's just a one-way relationship.
Right.
Dana comes in and takes Clint hostage. I see, Dana, you can make a decision whether I live or die. I do whatever you ask of me. I want you to succeed, but you could really care less about me. You're a sociopath, a psychopath. You're using me for whatever you have to use me for, but there's no relationship that's developed there. A Stockholm Syndrome, you know, we hear the term bandied around a lot, but I don't know, Dana, that develops a whole lot. I mean, there have been some who said, aha, that's what happened with Patty Hearst, and
right.
That's probably right with Patty Hearst. We know she was held hostage. She eventually identified with the Symbolese Liberation Army. She participated in a bank robbery with them under another name, she assumed. But then we look at somebody like Elizabeth Smart, a young girl who was kidnapped in Salt Lake a few years ago, who was held for 9 months. And people say, well, you know, she identified with her aggressor. She was, you know, sexually assaulted a number of times. She had a chance to escape, and she never escaped.
Right.
But she also kept a diary, and she kept it in French that her hostage taker couldn't read. And in it, she said how much she hated and loathed this guy. So that identification didn't take place at that time anyway.
Self-preservation is an aspect that needs to be looked at here. Everyone deals with situations differently. How important or how applicable is that in the Hornbeck case and Elizabeth Smart? Trying to get away is one thing, but being scared to death and thinking, well, I can't do anything else but be here is another thing.
Well, you know, what bothers me, Dana, is that there are a lot of, couch potatoes who are rendering their opinion. Well, you know, they kids should have got away. And I mean, there's a talk show host on Fox Television who made the ridiculous statement that this kid must have enjoyed being this, that he didn't have to go to school. So, you know, he's suggesting he might have been a willing participant.
Exactly.
Now, you got to realize that the hostage taker in this case, the kidnapper, I think, is more appropriate. The kidnapper in this case, Michael Devlin, as you know, he's 6'4", 300 pounds, and used a firearm when he kidnapped these children. And Sean, who I was with last Thursday when I was on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and I was sitting right next to him and talked to him. But at the time he was kidnapped, he was less than 5 foot tall. He was less than 100 pounds. So you take this mountain of a man kidnapper who, by force, intimidation, use of a weapon, jerks you out of everything that you ever knew, the safety and comfort and security of your home, your parents, your school, your church, your friends, substitutes himself for that, threatens your life, threatens the life of your parents. We're told perhaps woke Sean up for a period of time every 15 minutes throughout the night, threatened him. You know, there's an identification with the aggressor, I think, that takes place that is just what you said. It's self-preservation. It's, I will do whatever it takes, and your body and your mind kicks in to saying, I will survive and I will do what I'm told. And after a while, you know, it's like a POW in Korea, where they were just broken, where maybe not Sean's body, although if from what I saw, just when I saw that young man and the emotions that I saw in him the other day, I mean, that looked like a broken young man. But, right. You know, you can break someone psychologically, and you can put psychological handcuffs on a person. You can put emotional bars around somebody that I think are really stronger than any steel bars in any prison.
It's a catch-22 here right now as far as the media coverage and involving Sean personally. What good or what bad does that do? Obviously, it educates the public and it educates parents, but by parading the young lad in front of the television camera and on the air, does this help him psychologically?
No, I saw something good take place the other day. When we were on Oprah's show on Thursday, and I was there simply to share what had happened to me when I was taken by a predator when I was a child, and I talked about that on air, and then I was there to talk about what you know, my perception as a behavioralist, as a hostage negotiator, what Sean was going through. And, you know, we got to the point the show was just about over with, and he was asked to come up on stage, you know, for the perfunctory group hug,
right.
And where he and his parents and Oprah would be standing together. And, you know, they said, come on up, Sean. And he shook his head, no, I don't want to. And he looked over at me, Dana.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I looked at him, I said, Sean, you don't have to. I said, yeah. I think it's a good decision not to go up. And I said, you can tell people you're not going to do something, and that's a good decision. And he
right.
kind of smiled, and he reached out and shook my hand. And I think there's a number of things going on. I think his parents, for whatever the reason, believe they are helping other children. They're helping the public by getting the story out. I think they're trying to express their appreciation by doing interviews. And I think the balance is, and realize that they had the advice of police, the prosecutor's office, the FBI, psychologists who are working with them, and their own opinion. And, you know, they I don't think they've been paid to do any of this, and I don't see them looking for their 15 minutes of fame. But the balance is that helping Sean, is that just saying, okay, you know, the media's going to rag us to death for 1 week, so let's get out, let's do some key interviews, and then let's pull our head back in again, which I think the family's going to do now.
Right.
Or would it have been better to just, you know, been a World War II submarine, drop below the surface, say we're not going to do interviews, we're not going to do them, and be just hounded to death by
exactly.
the media,
yeah.
which you and I know they're going to do. So,
yeah.
you know, maybe there's part of it that says let's get it out of the way, let Sean make some initial appearances. But, you know, some of the things that the media is so cruel. I mean, they're coming out now suggesting, and it's true, but saying that, you know, Sean's biological father, who died years ago, where he had been in jail as for a sexual offense against a child. I don't know what good it is to roll that information out. So now you have Sean with his parents having acknowledged he might have been sexually molested, which most of the world probably thought anyway. Now they're telling that his father had been a predator, his biological father, before he died. I mean, you know, you think of all the emotional wounds and scars this kid has already, and it's like they're pumping more holes into him.
If you're just joining us, Clint Van Zandt is here. We're talking about the Devlin case, Michael Devlin, charged with kidnapping Ben Ohmby and Sean Hornbeck. Let's talk about the law enforcement perspective of this, Clint. It's going to come out. It started already a little bit. What were the cops doing? This kid went and told them about his bicycle being stolen. The cops got called to there because of a parking complaint. Why weren't they doing their jobs? Why didn't they notice that this was Ben Ohmby missing for the, or Sean Hornbeck or Ben Ohmby missing? What are these dumb cops doing? That's going to happen. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's going to happen. Well, as you know, I can speak for the United States. There's about 750,000 cops, and these are men and women just like in Canada who are by and large busting their butt every day to do a good job, low pay, long hours. And here we were about almost 100 miles from Sean's home. A number of years had gone by. His hair was different, his face was different than the projected image of what he would look like. He now had piercings on his face. A couple of street cops who were investigating a stolen bicycle or anything else would have picked him out from the tens of hundreds, maybe thousands of kids that they look at every year. I don't fault these cops in the past for not saying, aha, there's somebody who looks like this. I guess if I'm going to fault anybody, it's like the neighbors around who knows this kid's around there all day, who knows he's not going to school. It's the friends and neighbors who at one time said to Sean, you look like Sean Hornbeck, or is that you? And he just kind of blew it off. Where are those kids and where are those adults who had the legitimate suspicions that should have called the cops and let it run it down and didn't do it? We are such a busy world, a busy society. It's none of our business what anybody else is doing. So what if the kid doesn't go to school? So what if he looks like Sean Hornbeck, the missing kid? It's not my business to call. Our world turns around, and I don't want to moralize too much, but until we realize we are our neighbor's keeper, we are our brother's keeper, we can't expect the cops to do the job that we're supposed to be doing as responsible citizens if we don't do it first.
Absolutely. Let's talk about Michael Devlin here a little bit. The proverbial media interview, and in this case and others, when they talk to the neighbor, the neighbor always says, he was kind of a nice guy. He was quiet, kept to himself. I can remember the BTK interviews.
Sure.
Oh, what a nice guy. What a nice guy. But he wasn't really a nice guy. What kind of a fella is Michael Devlin?
Well, we're hearing these stories about him here, that he's a loner, that he's got diabetes, that he's lost some toes off his foot, that, he's really into video games and he likes to play, some equivalent to interactive games on the internet that he gets involved in. And he said in an interview he had with the media here within the last day or so that, he really doesn't care about sex or about women one way or the other. And, I had a tough life and I was adopted and, this crap have you starting to, kind of build up a feel sorry for me type of defense. But, if in fact he's guilty of what he's charged with and if in fact there was an ongoing sexual relationship, physical relationship that he forced on this young man. And of course, somebody under 16 can't volunteer to have a sexual relationship with an adult. That's still going to be a statutory responsibility. If in fact he's guilty of that, we're dealing with, I think, probably a preferential pedophile. As pedophiles, they may like little boys, they may like little girls, they may like them a certain age, they may like certain body types. But I think what we're seeing with Sean Hornbeck and then the subsequent kidnapping of Ben Ohmby, Sean when he was kidnapped and Ben now, they were about the same Even though Ben was a couple of years older, he looks younger. So they both, Sean was 11, Ben looked like he was 11. They were both under 5 foot tall. They were both very small boys, size-wise. And I think we're, you know, again, should Devlin be guilty, I think we're going to find a preferential predator who wanted that age, wanted that body style of individual for his victim. And what we may find out is that Sean was just getting too old. Sean at 15 was starting to go into manhood, and Devlin may not have liked that. He may have wanted to get himself a new boy again who met that ideal type of body style, age, another compliant victim. So he went out and got another one. And, you know, I think what we're going to find, Dana, there's going to be aspects of this story that, you know, are going to come out for quite a while between the relationship between Devlin, Sean, and the limited relationship with Ben. And, you know, it's hard for me to imagine that Devlin, he's 41 now, so he was 37 when he kidnapped Sean. This guy didn't just fall off of the punkin wagon at 37 years old and start kidnapping and potentially sexually abusing boys. You and I, investigatively, and I think the FBI is doing it right now, they're going back 20 years, yep. and they're looking at any missing person or child murder case that took place in Illinois, Missouri, within about, 100 miles, 150 miles of where Devlin lived, just to see what other crimes he might be good for along that same line.
Yeah, cold case investigators should be looking at red flags popping up all over the place with Michael Devlin. If we looked at a picture of Michael Devlin when he was 11, 12, 13 years of age, or a picture of Michael Devlin's friends at that age, I'm trying to get into the profile a little bit. Why boys like this, Clint? Would we see something similar?
Well, sometimes you find preferential child predators that have a childlike mind, and they are relating back to when they were a child, to when they dealt with that. I don't want to get too Freudian, because I really can't climb in this guy's mind, and there's part of me that just doesn't want to, because I don't want to have to climb back out again.
Exactly.
And, the shrinks can spend all the time they want to engaging in psychobabble and come up with a defense for what this guy is and how tough his life is, but you and I have been on the street too many years. We know people make choices, and you can make a choice to commit a crime. You can make a choice to be a predator. I'll go to my grave telling you that is not genetic to be a child predator, number one.
Right.
And number two, I am such an advocate of a one-strike law in this country that if someone offends, molests a child, sexually assaults a man or a woman, as far as I'm concerned in the United States, if you're going to spend my tax money, do it by putting a predator who touches a child or another person in a sexual manner. I want one strike and that person is out. I want them in jail. I don't want them out again. Here in the U.S., the child molester will molest somewhere between 50 and 150 children before he ever comes to the attention of the criminal justice system. One guy was arrested in California last year who kept meticulous records of 25,000 individual acts of child molestation that he had committed. I don't want these bastards on the street, Dana. I don't want them to have access to my grandchildren, to anybody else's children. I don't think these guys can be healed. I don't want to go into the psychobabble. I don't think there's magic medicine that can help them. And I guess as an FBI profiler, I remember talking to one guy who said, I'll do whatever you want me to. He was in jail as he had molested and murdered some children. And he said, Danny, he said, I will do everything you want me to. I'll go to classes. I'll be educated. I'll take saltpeter. He says, all I want to do is get back on the street again. And he says, you put me back on the street and I will sexually assault and murder children all over again. Well, Washington State took care of that. Mm-hmm. They made sure that guy would never, ever have the chance to do that again. But I'm just afraid there are too many guys out there like that, and they scare the heck out of me for the sake of our children. And my tax money, if I could sign my check over every year, my tax dollars, it would be put these guys in jail and don't let them out again, if, in fact, they are guilty. Now, I'm not saying you know, and people are going to say, well, what if the person is 18 and he's having a consensual sexual relationship with a 15-year-old? No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about someone who forcibly kidnaps and molests and sexually assaults. That's the guy I want off the street and never to get a chance to do that to a child again.
And hopefully our legislators will think the same way, and they'll put the funds in to put more policemen on the street and do what we can to protect our children. You have something called livesecure.org on the internet that gives tips and information on how to protect our kids. For the parents that are listening out there, or for interested listeners, how do we, or what can we do, Clint, to protect our children more, to protect them from the Michael Devlins that are out there?
Well, I think, you know, number one, we've got to make sure we have an open line of communication with our children. They have to know that they can tell us anything and everything, that they're not going to be punished. They have to know that, you know, that if they are a victim, it's not their fault. I mean,
right.
You know, real quick, when I was 7 years old, I lived in the inner city in Illinois. My house was about a half a block from a drugstore, a convenience store, you might call it today. And every day my parents would send me down to pick up the local newspaper. It was a half a block away. It was on a nice wide city sidewalks and streets. I would walk down, pick up the paper, and walk back again. And, you know, I 7 years old again, and I can remember walking down the street, and from my peripheral vision on my left-hand side, I see this guy coming out from between a couple of houses, and he comes to me, Dana, and he says, hey, little boy, would you like to see some new puppies?
Right.
And I, you know, absolute classic lure of a predator, of a child molester, and I knew my parents had told me, you know, don't go with strangers, but the idea of new puppies. And Dana, I remember this guy reaches out and takes me by the hand, and he leads me between these houses. And he takes me back in this old rickety wooden garage, and we go in, and he closes the door behind us. And there, you know, it's daylight out, and the garage is somewhat closed up, but some of the boards are missing, and there's light coming into the building enough in this garage, and I can see, and I can look around, and there are no new puppies or anything else. And this guy demands that I perform a sexual act on him, and he starts moving forward on me. And, you know, whether it's a combination of drugs or booze or drunk or stupid, he lunged at me, and he missed. And I sidestepped his hand, and I went around him. And Dana, at seven, I hit that door, and that door gave at 7 years old, and the door opened, and I burst into the sunlight.
Right.
And I ran, to the store, and I bought the newspaper, and I ran home. And I never told my parents what happened. And the reason I didn't was because I thought I was wrong. I knew I was wrong. I had done what my parents had told me not to do, and I thought I would be punished for it. You know, Dana, I told my mother 2 years ago for the first time. 2 years ago. I mean, I'm talking something that took place over half a century ago.
Right.
And, you know, here, 25-year career FBI agent, and as a child, I made a terrible mistake, number one, by going with the guy, and number two, I compounded a felony because I didn't tell my parents, and I left that guy out there.
Right.
And by me not telling, I gave him the opportunity to offend against another child. And, you know, that's a horrible mistake that I made. But had, I guess, my parents stressed stronger, and had I been smarter to understand what my responsibility was, that it wasn't my fault, that, you know, that guy was wrong, that I, you know, I did something wrong, but I needed to tell my parents. That's type of line of communication, number one. So if we're talking to our kids, and number two, if when they're young, they understand the classic lures that a predator would use, and we give our children, we don't want to make them paranoid, but we want to give them a frame of reference. So if something like that happens, they have an understanding. If somebody, you know, they walk down the middle of a sidewalk, not on one side or the other, so they can be grabbed. They know not to be lured over to a car. Hey, little boy, would you give me directions? Or, hey, you know, your father has been injured. He told me to come pick you up in a car and take you. Or if somebody's driving a car and they're driving in the same direction you're walking and they try to lure you in, the child needs to know to do a 180 and run the other way, because this way the guy would have to turn the car all the way around and go back again. And all these things that a parent can tell a child so we can forearm our children. If this happens, they have a frame of reference to act on.
Absolutely. If we can't protect our kids, and I don't know what we can and do, and, you know, you, with your work and with mine and what the media does in most cases, then we're able to find the Ombies and the Hornbecks, and we need to work harder at it. But I guess the bottom line or the last word for you, Clint, tonight would be, if you had a message to parents, what would that be if all of a sudden they find that their son or daughter is missing? What's the very first thing they should do?
Yeah, two things. Number one, you know, search your entire house and yard and do it very quickly. Number two, immediately call the police. Immediately call the police and get them to help. You know, one thing I've been sharing real quick too, Dana, is that, you know, like most people carry a cell phone, and most cell phones now have a camera built into it. And I was talking to my daughter who lives up in Boston, who my grandchildren are ages 3 and 5. And my daughter told me, you know, once a month she'll use her camera phone and take a new picture of her children. Well, she uses it as kind of the wallpaper on the camera phone, but it gives her a fresh picture of her children all the time. She's not carrying a 9-month-old or 1-year-old school picture. She has a fresh picture there. So, you know, if your child does go missing, do that first search real quick yourself. Number two, involve law enforcement. And number three, be ready to provide a current picture, current information, so that the police can help in that search. Even though, you know, we talk about the first 24 or 48 hours, we know that if we don't get a child back within the first 4 hours and he's taken by a very serious child predator, we may not get that child back. So the clock is running against us, and parents, law enforcement, the community, we've got to team up together to stop these guys, and if they get their hands on our kids, we got to get them back as fast as we can.
Great advice. Clint, thank you. I appreciate it. You're always welcome on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye. Clint Van Zandt will be right back with Jan Smolinski. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pritzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Of course, our webpage is located at www.scaredmonkeys.com. Printout from the internet here I did a little while ago, 880 days, 16 hours, 44 minutes, and 29 seconds since William Billy Smolinski was last seen. been missing since August 24th, 2004. He'd be 33 years of age now. Male, white, light brown hair, blue eyes, approximately 6 foot in height, 200 pounds. His birthday, 14th of January, 1973. He's missing from Waterbury, Connecticut, USA. He has a tattoo of a blue cross with the name Pruitt in the cross on the left forearm, a tattoo of a blue cross with an orange outline on his right shoulder. His left ear is pierced with a small diamond. We talk about missing people all the time on my program, and sadly there are missing people everywhere. And the media sometimes is a little remiss when it comes to covering missing persons cases. They do a little bit for a while, and it's really good, and then after that, when maybe the public's interest wanes or no leads come forward, we've been talking with Drew Kesey now, and of course the Holloway case and all these sorts of cases. Tonight I have Jan Smolinski. She is William Smolinski, Billy Smolinski's mom, on with me, and I want you to go to the webpage, www.justice4billy, that's the number four, so www.justice4billy, all one word, .com, to learn more about Bill Smolinski. And I think it says here, there's no wisdom greater than kindness, and the best kindness here would be some information on how to find Billy. Jan Smolinski, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell us about Bill, Billy. And August 24th, 2004, when did you first find out that Billy had gone missing?
Billy went to Florida for a week previous his disappearance. He came home. He had a German Shepherd, which he loved dearly, and he had a girlfriend previous to the one he had take care of his dog. And apparently he had told the neighbor he was going away for 3 days up north.
Right.
And when Billy wasn't around, we felt that there was a problem immediately, and we called the police, but the police said because he had told the neighbor 3 days, we had to wait the 3 days.
Hmm.
A lot happened in the meantime. You know, just listening to the neighbor is the only one that said that. So we waited, and on the third day, the police took it nonchalant, you know, like he had just left on his own, and we knew that it was different. So, you know, and it's been 2.5 years, and we've had an uphill battle all the way.
And when
the FBI is in on the case.
Okay. When you mean an uphill battle, what do you mean by that?
Well, the police, we had to do our own search. And I uncovered a lot since then.
Mm-hmm.
I found out that the state police have a helicopter with heat-treated equipment that could have swept the banks of the river within a few minutes, and it took us 3 days. We found out that the whole police department didn't even know my son was missing, and when we had the search party, one of the officers approached my brother-in-law and asked him what he was doing on the road, crossing the road to the river. And my brother-in-law said, my nephew is missing. And he said, who's your nephew? He didn't even know. So the police were supposed to have a roll call, and they never did. And, you know, we asked for search dogs. They never got the search dogs. My daughter had to get the search dogs. And just, you know, all I wanted to let everyone know that is if they have a missing person, they really should check to make sure that everything is being done. You know, with my further just investigating what was going on, our DNA was taken, and it was lost 3 different times, lost or misplaced. And all I wanted it was entered into the national database, the CODIS system.
Right.
And I had learned that from just making phone calls, and I found a really caring assistant coroner in Nevada who helped me and educated me in the CODIS system. And I found out that, you know, police not only in our area, but police all over the country are not educated in the the National Database CODIS system. Well, you know, we had to actually sit down and tell the chief of police what the system was. So, we had thought previous, once they first took the first DNA sample, that everything would have been entered properly, but that's not the case.
Is this an issue of training? There's a nonchalant attitude that comes from police departments sometimes in missing persons cases. Jan, I've covered many missing person cases on my program here. Dave Holloway, the very first thing he was told is, sit down, she's probably out drinking somewhere, or you'll see her in a little while. I've had people that have had no response from police departments, and we have organizations like Texas Equisearch, Tim Miller, who volunteers that come out to try and help small police departments that aren't educated or aren't trained, or in this case they did have the equipment but may not have all the equipment. What would you like to see done as far as police departments? You mentioned the CODA system, education, training. Obviously, there's some issues that need to be taken care of, because you certainly weren't served by the police department the way you should have been.
No, we weren't served. And I feel that the police do need an education. Our system is broken. And with the technology we have in our country, it's a shame that this is going on. The police do need an education, all of them, throughout the country, on the national database collecting the DNA. I found out that coroners, medical assistants, and law enforcement hardly have any communication. And if there is remains or a body found, a body could be in a morgue for months, which there is a case in this country, where in the same city where the family searching for their loved one. So, our system really needs upgrading, and I know it lacks funding. And I have a friend right now whose daughter, my friend is from Arkansas, whose daughter may be at the bottom of a mine shaft in California, and we're working together on this, and we're hoping to go to the White House and see if we can gain some funding for the national database and also for the National Center for Missing Adults, which is running out of funds.
Well, if we can't help find the missing or help families get answers, I hate the term closure, because in this case, in these sorts of cases, there is no closure. This is something that you have with you for the rest of your lives. And if they can't come up with the funding for this, then I don't know what they're thinking for sure. If you're just joining us, Jan Smolinski is here. We're talking about her son, Billy, who has been missing. Tell us about Billy, the person.
Billy, he's a fun-loving type person. He came from, my husband and I have been married for 36 years, so he came from a family, a really old-fashioned family, which, he didn't realize what type of people are out there. And I think he pretty much got wrapped up into a situation that he couldn't handle.
And how do you mean by that?
Well, we feel that he's no longer here.
Right.
I don't know who's responsible for his disappearance. All I know is that Billy has a girlfriend who was dating a politician, and my son had made a phone call to the politician the day he disappeared.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if there's any connection here. The only thing that is bizarre is that the girlfriend was taking down thousands of missing persons posters that we had hung on telephone poles in certain towns. The rest of the towns, we have posters everywhere. But we've even got this on videotape, and if anyone wants to read the story, it's on justiceforbilly.com. And a bizarre twist, I was arrested as a criminal for hanging a flyer of my son in this particular town where the politician is. It's a very strange story, and it's still ongoing.
Well, it's a story that needs to be told. You were arrested for hanging a flyer? Is it some sort of city ordinance as far as putting something on a pole or what?
No. I guess we had, my daughter and I had gone into the police department previous to that a couple weeks earlier, and we had just finished videotaping because this girlfriend was taking down my son's flyers, not only with her car, but with a school bus. And the only way we could get anyone to listen to us is to videotape. And we did. So we brought her into the police department, and thinking that the police would help us, they threw five charges against my daughter and myself. But the bus company owner came in with one of the officers and said they'll drop all five charges if we did not take our videotape to Channel 8 News. So at that time, we didn't realize what the situation was, so we just, you know, left with the videotape in our hand.
Right.
Well, 2 weeks later, I get a phone call at home saying that I'm arrested. Come in, turn myself in, and if I don't, they're going to handcuff me and bring me in when I'm in town. And because criminal trespassing first degree, disorderly conduct. And since then, I found that there were two other charges on my court affidavit. There were false charges. The state police have no record of that whatsoever.
Wow.
So apparently, what they wanted to do was scare us out of town. But, you know, my son is missing. Right. I want to find my son, and I'm not going to give up until I get him whatever happened to him.
Is there an active investigation going on regarding your disappearance of your son by any law enforcement agency?
Now that the FBI has it, the FBI has full investigation right now. And we're very happy, you know, they are active on it.
Wow, this story is one that needs to be told more. And, Jen, you are welcome to come back on the program again. Just mention the webpage one more time, please.
That's www.justiceforbilly.com, and the whole story is on there. You'll be able to read it.
And you have a link on there, I believe, for anyone with information that can be kept confidential regarding the disappearance of your son?
Yes, I do.
Absolutely. Okay. Jan Smolinski, thanks for dropping by, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow. www.justiceforbilly.com. Got another story here. Police in Indiana and Chicago and the FBI are looking for 30-year-old Jerry D. White. Elkhart police have named him in an arrest warrant for the attempted murder and several counts of confinement. While it is believed he's holding his ex-girlfriend, 31-year-old Kimberly Walker, and their four children, Jalen Walker, Justin Walker, Kyara Walker, and 16-month-old Kayla Walker. If you have any information on Jerry D. White, contact your local law enforcement agency. We haven't had an update on the Duckett matter or the lawsuit against Nancy Grace and CNN in a bit. I'm going to try and get a hold of J. Paul Daratani, attorney for the Duckett family. You are listening to the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. I'll be right back.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, growing like a breeze. Country roads take me home to the place. Gather round her, miners, ladies, strangers. blue water. Dark and dusty, painted on the sky.
Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show for January 21st, 2007. A case that we haven't heard much about in the media in the last little while is the Duckett matter. There's been a lawsuit filed against Nancy Grace and CNN regarding the death of Melinda Duckett. Trenton Duckett is still missing. I thought I'd invite back attorney J. Paul Derritani, who represents the Duckett family, on the program. J. Paul, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Dana. How are you?
I'm doing great. What's been going on? We haven't heard much about this case in the media lately. I thought I'd bring you on the air and see if you could update us.
Well, in terms of the civil aspect of the case, in other words, the lawsuit, the CNN and Nancy Grace, they've filed a what's called a motion to transfer the case from state court to federal court. We filed a petition to remand it back to state court. So it's kind of caught in that quagmire between courts.
Right.
CNN hired certainly a good group of lawyers. They're not playing around. They're fighting this every step of the way, and the next step is to see whether we remain in the court where we really should be, which is Florida State Court, or we wind up in federal court. We don't think the motion's very well taken on their side, but that's generally where we're at. In terms of the binding Trenton, a lot of leads have come in, a lot of different things, and I'm not really at liberty to expand too much on an ongoing investigation, but
right.
I think that the Marion County Sheriff's already indicated, or maybe it was Leesburg, that's indicated that they think the baby's alive, and we still hold hope that he is alive. And generally, we think there may be more information coming out in the future in terms of the criminal matter or the finding of Trenton. We just wait and see.
The big part of this case, or a part that I know I'll be following, and I'm sure members of the public will be following, is something I'll call the power of the press. How important is it to deal with the conduct of a media personality? Let's look at the case here, and I know you're not directly involved with it, where the radio station had the contest where the young mother died because she drank water and passed away to try and win a $250 video game system to a Nancy Grace or a talk show host that batters and berates a guest until they allegedly take their own lives because of it. Where do you see the aspect of that, J. Paul, as far as this case goes?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think what we see is generally, I don't know if we call it a dumbing down or a disrespect of society, but
right.
You know, you have people who are, whether they be radio personalities, the one that you're speaking of, and I thought that case a little bit, and I just think it's a travesty.
Jeez, yes.
I think her family has a good case, but in the meantime, this woman who is trying to make some money for her child and try to do something good is dead. So it's whether you have a good civil case or not, it's kind of irrelevant when the person is deceased. But the bottom line is I just see that certain people in the media, certain people in the press are going too far with things. I know we've always had the Jerry Springer-type shows. We've had the outrageous TV. We've had the reality shows. But, the court TVs, the sensationalism that's going on, even good stations such as CNN where they have in big caps dead, we're dead with regard to our soldiers, there's a disrespect and a real disconnect that's going on. And I hope some lawsuits, more lawsuits come out and maybe bring people around again to show some respect and some honesty and decency in the way they report and the way they handle sensitive situations and sensitive matters.
Is it an arrogance where the media, you can't touch us, will say or do whatever we can? It just makes my skin crawl. I'm not sure if you heard the audio of the disc jockey in this case where the young mother died, where he laughed and said, well, nobody's died yet, but they signed waivers, so we're okay. Is there that arrogance that comes from some media personalities that they're untouchable?
I heard that same thing, Dana, and I was just disgusted by that. You know, it's like anything. I think that probably maybe 80-90% of politicians are good. 80-90%, believe it or not, of lawyers are good. And I think there's a lot of terrific newscasters out there that do have class and integrity. But those rotten apples, that 10%, and boy, those folks at that radio station just, in my mind, represent pure, deliberate, malicious conduct. And it's an outrage. But it's that 10% that winds up destroying the image of a great profession, such as your profession, such as good radio announcers as yourself and other people and good journalism out there. And I think they're taking it that one step further and one step further, that 10% or 20% or whatever you want to call it of the trash out there is expanding upon the worst possible things to do, and they just keep going with it. And they keep, I think they heighten it and they try to get more shock value and more shock value. And it's just disgusting.
You know, it's the old, if it bleeds, it leads mentality. And I think the people out there are smart enough to know better. However, like you say, there's a young mother who's trying to win a game system for her children. I would have sooner given her the $250 rather than see her drink, you know, drown in her own water over a stupid system like this. There has to be some culpability on the part of the media as far as what they're doing, whether it's, I'll use the term Gestapo tactics, and that's my term, not yours, of an interviewer, or if it's just a dumb, stupid contest to try and give something away that really isn't worth that much. Anyway, there needs to be some answers. What's next, Jay Paul, in this case?
I'm sorry, I lost the last part of what you just said.
Sure. What's next for you in this case? Basically, wait well till the courts figure out what jurisdiction it's going to be handled in?
Yeah, that's the big step. And, you know, we're trying to. I go on this station in different medias, and I was on the doing a question and answer session line today. You know, the thing that we wanted to do was turn the debate away from the Nancy Grace type tactic where she is, in my mind, at least from her implications and her statements, she assumed the baby was dead and that Melinda had something to do with it.
Right.
And we wanted to bring it out that, you know, this baby still may be alive, and we hope that people are looking at it because, you know, with the Amber Alert and with the passing of information now, we're trying to keep his name out there.
Yep.
There's been a lot of other kids, and thank God that child that was recovered last week.
Yes.
And that's wonderful. But, you know, we think Trenton's alive. We want to get on stations like yours. We want people, because somebody who may be listening to your show, maybe at a rest area, maybe somewhere, and they may see that baby.
Yep.
So that's our goal with that respect. And I think we have turned the debate around a little bit with the lawsuit.
Yep.
The next step with the lawsuit, unfortunately, lawsuits don't go quickly. And once we think that we'll be back in state court, but once we are there, then it's a matter of setting up what we call depositions, where we start producing our witnesses and they produce their witnesses and we get ready for trial. And at this point, it's real early in the case. We have no idea when the case will be at trial. But hopefully, maybe the end of next summer would be our goal.
Well, I think you're doing a good thing. Some people need to be held accountable, and the system itself needs to be looked at. But like you say, the main goal here is to find Trenton and return him back to his family. Jay Paul, thanks. You're always welcome on this program.
Oh, thank you, Dana. Have a good night.
Take care, bud. Bye-bye. That's Jay Paul Derritani, attorney for the Duckett family. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
Stood a long cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named You will be the leader of a big old band. Many people coming from miles around to hear you play your music when the sun go down. Maybe someday your name will be in lights saying, Johnny, be good tonight. Go, 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 Johnny, go. 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 Go, Johnny, be good.
And you're listening to the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. My name's Dana Pretzer. Aptly, we call this the Dana Pretzer Show. Our webpage is located at www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio, www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can listen to the show live. You can hear past shows, download podcasts, listen to my daily commentary, whatever. We'll be back in a couple of minutes here with Dave Holloway here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show for January 21st, 2007. It's been much too long since Natalie Holloway disappeared that the family is still battling every day to try and get answers. I hate the word closure. Closure, as I've said before many times in this program, is not an option here because this will never be closed. But Natalie does deserve to be returned home, and the family deserves answers. In this case, we haven't had an update from a family member in a little while, so I thought I'd bring Dave Holloway on the program tonight to talk about the case and give us any updates that he can. Dave, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Dana.
What's been in the media lately? Some things that we can't discuss, but some things that we can. In particular, the fact that Karen Johnson has left the case, so to speak, and is no longer the prosecuting attorney. Jossie Mansour said that on my program about 3 weeks ago. It's been reported in the media a little bit since then. I'm curious on your thoughts, Dave, about Karen, the type of job that she's done, and have you been given any information as far as who the new prosecutor will be, or have you had any contact with he or she?
Well, John spoke with her about a week ago, and from what we understand is her contract expired after 3 years serving as a prosecutor. She asked to renew that contract to see this case through, and the Attorney General refused.
Now, is it because of the Natalie case? Is it because there's been so much media attention? I'm asking you to speculate a little bit here, but it seems funny that someone has gone so long with something and now all of a sudden they no longer have it. Or is this a case where they actually want a fresh start, so to speak?
you know, you asked me to speculate, Dana, and I'm going to do that. I think it's the fact that, you know, this is a results-oriented business, and she has not had any results in solving the case. So if you were asked me, that's why I think the contract was not renewed. You know, maybe they'll get someone in that will have a new, fresh look at it. There was, in the beginning, there was some dissension among some of the workers in the prosecutor's office that may have played a part in it. I'm not sure. I know that there was some infighting there in the beginning. And, you know, and as you recall, probably 3 or 4 months into the case, we had asked the attorney general to, you know, let's just start all over and get, you know, the Dutch involved and get a new prosecutor. And that's what's been happening throughout the case. I mean, we've seen a police chief, all the ranks within the police department have fallen to the wayside, and now the prosecutor's office has as well.
One has to wonder, when the focus was turned to the security guards and away from the boys initially, how much involvement the prosecuting attorney had with that, because that certainly was a downturn as far as the investigation goes.
Well, Danny, you've been involved in the police arena for some time, and it takes a team of people, and that's the police department, the prosecutor, and the judge to see things through. And, you know, and I guess in defense of Karen, she had to put together a case based on what the police put together. And, you know, there's still one individual that probably bears all the responsibility for the way the case has been going on, and that's the lead investigator in this case. He's still on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you always turn back and look at the May 31st witness statements of Deepak and Satish. On May 31st, they gave a statement following Yoren's statement, and in that statement, near the very end, they ask the question, did you drop Yoren and Natalie off at the fisherman's huts? And the answer was no, and then they proceeded on with them implicating the security guards. And then the following day, Beth indicates that Yoren's statement was ripped up. And by the way, Yoren's father assisted Yoren with his statement. From what I understand, he sat in the interview. But
yeah.
I arrived Wednesday on June the 1st, and this same detective, despite what was said in these statements, pretty much had cleared these kids. And sent us off on a. She ran away.
Yeah.
Go down to the bar, have a beer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And all the way up until Dana, I guess, 5 or 6 months into the case, he still would not accept the fact that this.
Are you still there, Dave?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. I thought I lost you there for a second. One of the things that we haven't heard about here, and I know I've discussed this with you on past shows, is the cold case investigation. Is there actually, or was there actually, a cold case investigation done, or was that just a lot of rhetoric from Aruba?
Well, I think what the Dutch are doing is just that. I understand approximately 10 detectives are involved in this case. I wouldn't think it would be full time. You know, you were a police officer at one time. You handle a bunch of different cases all at once. But they indicated that 10 detectives were involved in it, and I would think that would probably be the size of the office or whatever. And they refer to 10 detectives. You know, it all goes back to the police investigation. Your case is only as good as how the police have investigated, and as we all know, that has not been a very good job. So.
Yeah, and we've discussed this, and just before I had you on, I had Clint Van Zandt on this evening, and we were talking about investigations, and again, the first 48 hours is so important, and you know, the first 48 hours of this case was just a nightmare for sure. I got a few questions here, Dave, from the listeners,
sure.
If I could share those with you. This comes from the a listener who's quoting something from the Birmingham News. It says U.S. Representative Spencer Baucus said Saturday there were circumstances surrounding the Holloway disappearance that warranted the FBI being heavily involved. He declined to give details. He says the circumstances were very disturbing, and who formally requested the FBI's involvement. I can't get into it, but it's something the family is aware of. There was an immediate recognition that this was not simply a teen who wandered off. Is this something that you can discuss, Dave? What was the representative talking about as far as the circumstances being disturbing?
I think this was a statement made early on, and, you know, as the news media was watching, you know, there was a lot of, you know, did she run off? Was this a homicide or whatever? And the FBI concluded, you know, June 9th or 10th, after they brought these boys in, that this was a homicide case. And I think that's what he was referring to. It was not simply, you know, we missed our flight or I ran away or whatever. So I think that's what he was meaning by that, was in political terms, that this is a serious case.
Right. And absolutely. That's what it is. If you're just tuning in, Dave Holloway is here with me on the Dana Pretzer Show to talk about developments in the disappearance of his daughter, Natalie. Dave, the past few weeks I've done programs on people who have gone missing in Mexico and who have been murdered in Mexico, and made comparisons to Aruba, where you have two governments, one the Aruban government, one the Mexican government, are doing whatever they can to try and put aside any negativity towards their tourist economy, to try and make people not afraid to come there. Mexico is just as dangerous as you can get, and I think Aruba falls into that same category. Your thoughts on the government's response? Are they more interested in protecting the tourist dollar, or are they honestly wanting to get answers?
You know, there was a lot of cross currents during that time, Dana. There were some parts of the government, obviously, that were very, very concerned about how this would affect their tourism. In fact, the rumor got back to me was the worst thing that could happen to Aruba was the fact that they would find a missing person on Aruba, or find, you know, say, for instance, Natalie's body was found in Aruba. That would be detrimental to their tourism. And we saw a lot of deference that she ran away, or, you know, kick it off of Aruba and move it on to something else. You know, this could not possibly happen to this country. And that's the worst thing that they wanted, was that this would be labeled as a homicide. So
one of the questions that's come forward has been, there's been some information that's been some new searches in caves or other places in Aruba. Are you aware of that, Dave?
You know, there's always been some sort of searches. You know, people will call up and give tips and or say something, and, you know, and they'll, you know, rather than blow it off, they'll look into it. And but I don't think it's been, obviously the searches have not been as prevalent as they were, you know, a year ago. If any searches are going on, it's isolated type incidences, and you know, that's all I can say about that.
Okay.
Other than that, if it is, I'm not aware of one in a case.
Have the cold case detectives or anyone in Aruba given you a timeline as far as a report, or have you been receiving semi-regular updates?
Dana, I'll just be honest with you. I met with a individual who had contact with the team, but as far as direct contact with this team, we don't even know who they are.
Has the media...
No, we have not had a direct update or anything mm-hmm. with this cold case detective team.
Have the media and the government... I know we've gone over this before, but it's a question that keeps popping up. Because Natalie was in Aruba, it's difficult. But I don't totally buy that. Has the U.S. government helped enough? Could they help more? And can the media do more in this case for you, Dave?
As far as the government's concerned, all they can do is assist in the investigation if they're asked. In other words, if Aruba needs any information that's in the United States, they can assist with that. But as far as taking direct control or action or anything like that, you're looking at a situation where you've got to a sovereign country, and you have to be invited. In fact, you have to, from what I understand, you have to notify the government before you even come onto the island that you're coming, and obviously not in a legal capacity at that. So really nothing
John Q.
can do for you.
John Q. Kelly, as you mentioned, has been to Aruba and is spoken with the Aruban authorities most recently. Do you know if he'll be making any other trips soon, or will there be any other information coming out in the next little while?
You know, I certainly will not be making any trips. John will be doing any trips that are needed to go to Aruba. He'll be doing those. So to answer your question, he's the one that will be making the trips, if any are needed.
Well, I can tell you this, Dave, that myself, my audience, and everyone that's been involved in this case, we sit down every day and hope that you'll get the answers that you deserve and that Natalie will be brought home. Thanks for stopping on the program this evening.
Thank you, Dana.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Dave Holloway. We'll be right back. That's Mitch Ryder in the Detroit Wheels. I want to thank my guests this evening, Carmen Mercer, Clint Van Zandt, Jan Smolinski, J. Paul Derritani, and Dave Holloway for joining me here on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Again, our webpage, www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can listen to the show live download past shows, listen to them, the daily commentary. Everything that's involved with Scared Monkeys Radio is right there. And don't forget the Scared Monkeys webpage at www.scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you again real soon. Good night.
We will not tire, we will not falter, and we will not faint. Wanted, dead or alive. America wants him brought to justice. That's what we want. To get him running and to find him and to hunt him down. But we're going to smoke him out. Whether we bring our enemies to justice or bring justice to our enemies, justice will be done.
Wanted, dead or alive.
But make no mistake about it.
I want to bomb Osama back to the stage.